Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with book artists Amelia Bird and Katie Wallen of Baskerville Studio. We'll also talk with James Nolan, whose new collection of stories is You Don't Know Me. Bookmaking and printing have been around for a long time, but in this digital age, it's often easy to forget that they were once all done by hand. There's nothing like seeing an old printing press in action, or feeling the imprint of type on paper, or even making a book of your own. Baskerville Studio is a printmaking and letterpress design center in the Bywater, and the artists, called Hounds, of course, are committed to these literary arts. We have two Hounds of Baskerville with us today, book artist Amelia Bird and Katie Wallen. Amelia, Katie, thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Now, Baskerville is such a fun place to visit with all those printing presses and beautiful paper and type everywhere. Katie, tell us a bit about how the Hounds got together.
Well, Amelia and I know each other from graduate school at the University of Iowa, where I at least learned to print. I'm not actually sure where you started. And she moved down here. I moved behind her for other random reasons. And we were both looking, I think, for a home to continue our work. And she and another friend, Tyler Harwood, were teaching a class at Glassworks. And we were just looking for a place that had this equipment, and we couldn't really find one that was accessible. So we took that on as our job. And in October of last year, we signed a lease on an empty space and have spent the last year sort of making our creative work, sort of making that space functional.
It's such a great space because you go in there and you're overwhelmed by these huge printing presses, you know, and then there's Baskerville on one wall. But I should ask you, why Baskerville? Why not Garamond or Bodoni or some other typeface?
Well, we were looking for a name that felt like a location, because most of all what we are is a pied-à-terre, if you will, a ground place with the equipment that we need on it. And it happened that we had a lot of Baskerville, the typeface, and we were looking for a name, and we sort of landed on this as a possibility. And then we all adore the typeface. It rivals most typefaces in its beauty and its timelessness. And yeah, we just sort of adopted it as our patron type designer, our signature house typeface, and our name.
And I read somewhere that it was one of the first modern typefaces.
It's a transitional typeface.
That's transitional.
So from the old typefaces really mimicked the human hand and the calligraphic hand. And then there was a period of transition where those marks were lessened. They're creating them from metal, so they were just a lot more, I would use the word digital, but that's not the right word at all.
They're more refined, so they adjusted those marks. They have a level of delicacy and refinement, I think, in the transitional that can't be really achieved so easily by the hand. So actually it was in that vein.
And they're characterized by very thick and very thin strokes, transitional typefaces. But it predates truly modern faces that then look like the sans serif faces eventually.
Now, Amelia, your work has been featured in books like 500 Handmade Books. And I was drawn to your work because so much of it is inspired by literature. You've done books based on Walden and Gertrude Stein. Tell us about that.
Well, I've always been really interested. I mean, I came from a writing background. And so I feel like the literary tradition is just really in my blood. And it's how I got interested in making things by hand. It was just the love of the physical object and the love of the book. I also am really fascinated by handwork and handwriting and the interactions between those things. So one of my books is about marginalia that were written in copies of Walden. And so I went around to libraries all across the country looking at mostly first printings of Walden and looked at what people who had checked these books out of the library had written in the physical books. And I used those marginalia to make images for the book that I made. And it was really nice because it meant that I got very intimate with what people had written and how they had reacted to the text.
So how do you feel about writing in books? Like, what if you made a book and somebody wrote in it? Would you like that?
I think it would be a great compliment. I think it shows a real engagement.
Uh-huh. And an intention to keep, I guess,
yeah.
In some ways, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I can understand why you would want something untainted by that, too. And it definitely changes your reading. You're always reading something through layers anyway, through the layers of your own bias and through your own knowledge and experience. And why not add another, which is just somebody else's?
And that's why we have Post-its now. So that's my guilty pleasure, the Post-it. Now, Katie, I'm fascinated by your journey to become a book artist, just the way you described it. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's very generous of you to describe me that way. Not necessarily how I describe myself. I am an architectural historian by training. I'm not a scholar as much as a practitioner. I work in a historic preservation context. So I had been struggling in my own professional practice for many years with the writing piece, and I had been, I think, drawn to my profession by the sort of project base and this idea that I would be sort of working on something tangible. But in fact, that's not really what the profession is. So actually, I had been down here in New Orleans after Katrina and working and super burnt out. So I took a self-imposed sabbatical and I applied to the University of Iowa Center for the Book and was sure that I would be turned down, but they accepted me. And I went off to study book arts and letterpress printing because I had been pursuing sort of artistic classes in the community for a number of years, like really grasping at straws, trying to find something to hang on to sort of engage my creative mind. Because I think all of us who work anywhere, like our professions have been reduced to a screen and a mouse.
Not mine. No. Sorry.
I bet you sit in front of the screen and click the mouse more often than you bet.
I know. I do, actually.
So one summer, I went to the Penland School of Crafts, which is in North Carolina, and did a class on the poetics of placemaking, which I thought was a class that I could somehow do without any artistic foundation or background. And we made a book in that class. And that was it. That was a form that I could understand. And that actually writing for me became easier when it was reduced to that physical form and filling the pages in that way rather than sort of an endless page from Microsoft, which for me was paralyzing. So I found myself there, and it was much, much harder than I anticipated, and I anticipated it being quite hard. But I was, you know, I was 40 years old already, and I just didn't have any artistic training at all, and I was surrounded by these incredibly talented writers and artists who just sort of could take to it. So it was a very humbling experience, but very rich.
So what sort of book did you make in the placemaking class?
I think we made a book that was really just intended as a sort of a scrapbook. It was a Coptic binding. It was an Ethiopian binding. So actually, we'll be teaching that binding coming up. So it's a hardboard binding. It was a modern interpretation of a Coptic binding. And it was just intended as a way to sort of get us working with materials. And then we were going to expand it to sort of the landscape around us, but to sort of collect that information and hold it.
So you've been to two of the best schools for book arts in the country, Iowa
I'm so
and
so lucky.
And Amelia, where did you learn your craft?
I also learned at the University of Iowa. And I initially started taking bookbinding classes because I was in an MFA program for nonfiction writing. And I needed a way to get out of my head and do something physical. And I had always had a myriad of craft processes and I loved making things, but I had never really done much bookmaking until then. And I got so taken by it that after I graduated with my MFA, I couldn't stop thinking about, why didn't I learn how to print? Why didn't I learn how to print? Oh. So there was a year out of school that ran through my head. And then I went back and I learned how to print.
And the next thing you know, you're looking for these huge presses.
I know. Next thing I know, I want 3,000-pound machinery.
Oh, wow. Isn't that great? Isn't that empowering, though?
What's great is that it can happen.
Mm-hmm. So what are the sorts of things you want to do with Baskerville?
Well, our main goal to simply create a creative, inspiring, safe atmosphere for artists to work in. And that includes the members who are paying right now. There are six of us. And it also includes welcoming others into this space in ways that are safe and creative and inspiring for them. So that includes classes and also events with hands-on activities, hoping to get other younger people in the space and allow it to be accessible to the community as much as we can. And sometimes we take on partnerships where we'll print something for an organization we like, for a cause that we like, at or below costs. It's sort of a time-consuming, sometimes very expensive process, but we want that to be able to be used.
Now, you have a full series of classes coming up this fall with all kinds of topics. Tell us about some of those.
Yeah, we are really rolling out our classes this fall. This is something we've wanted to do for a while, and I think we finally have the quality instruction and the facilities ready to do that. And we have two different kinds of classes. One is a 6-week immersive class, and then we have 1 to 2 day workshops. So it just depends on the amount of time you have and how involved you want to get. The longer class this semester is Introduction to Bookbinding, Non-Adhesive Structures. The workshops we're teaching this semester are Paste Paper on September 20th. We have 3 letterpress workshops, one's on October 5th, November 2nd, and December 6th, and a 2-day Ethiopian binding workshop, and that's the Coptic structure that Katie alluded to earlier, and that's on December 18th and 19th.
And the Ethiopian binding is sewn, right?
Yes.
It's signatures and sewn on wooden boards, and it's totally awesome. It sits totally flat, which you have no idea how luxurious that is.
I know. I read that in the description. I thought, that is so true, because you really, it is a rare and wonderful thing to have a book that opens flat. So amazing. Well, I'm so excited to see what you all are going to come up with at Baskerville, and I can't wait to spend some more time with both of you and all of you, the Hall of the Hounds. We've been talking with Katie Wallen and Amelia Bird, who are two of the hounds of the Baskerville studio. Thanks so much, y'all.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you
for having us.
James Nolan is a 5th-generation native New Orleanian with the stories to prove it. He's here today to talk about his most recent collection of those stories, You Don't Know Me, new and selected stories. James has written 10 books, including Perpetual Care and Higher Ground, and the new poetry collection Drunk on Salt, and he is a longtime teacher of creative writing whose students have gone on to publish many books. James, welcome to The Reading Life. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back, Susan.
Now, you've written everything, essays, poems, novels, but what is it about the short story that keeps drawing you back?
The short story is a form of storytelling, and I'm very much in love with storytelling, being a New Orleanian, but it's compact. It's like a poem, and I like the succinctness of the short story. Creating an entire world with very few words, rather than in a novel, you immerse the reader in a longer, more epic experience. But a short story should have almost a poem-like impact on people.
Right.
I like that intensity.
And these stories are filled with real New Orleans characters, you know? So what is it that you look for when you're building a character? And why is it you stick so close to home?
When I have a story idea, the characters usually find me. I live in the French Quarter. All I have to do is kind of walk out my front door, and there's a story waiting for me. I don't tend to write very much about my own life. I tend to take off on sometimes seemingly minor things that happen to me and let my imagination do the work. Although I put a lot of personal emotions and conflicts and crises in the stories. The characters are usually people I dream up.
Well, they seem very real for them.
Well, that's what I hope.
I know. So I was curious. We have this image of the French Quarter writer, what it's like to live in the French Quarter. And so what is a normal work day like for you?
It's more like a normal work night for me.
I know. You don't do mornings.
I don't do mornings. I tend to write in the late afternoon and the evening and the early morning hours because it's blessedly quiet. And so one downside of living in the French Quarter is I live on a fairly busy street, Domaine at Royal, and the walking tours drive me a little crazy. So I really have to crank up the music to drown them out. Yeah.
You could take your revenge on those walking tours in fiction, can't you?
I've already done that in
Yes,
the Vampire Tour Diaries. I have definitely done that.
So when you put this collection together, you included stories from Perpetual Care as well as these new stories.
Right. There are 10 new stories and there are 10 stories from Perpetual Care. What happened is that Perpetual Care was a really popular and critical success and was much in demand in bookstores. Bookstore owners kept asking me where they could get copies. But unfortunately, the Rapscallion publisher in Chattanooga, Tennessee, closed the press and absconded with all of the royalties.
Oh, no.
So the book is actually out of print and difficult to find. So I decided to take 10 of the stories from Perpetual Care and add them to 10 new stories to do basically a whole new book so that people who have been fans of Perpetual Care or who are interested in reading the book can actually find the stories, and then there'll also be 10 new stories to introduce them.
So when you do that, when you bring back stories from another collection, do you revise them? Do you look at them again?
I did do some updating, and I tried to eliminate dates so they wouldn't appear so dated. And a few things I had to change, such as I had a director of St. Louis No. 3 Cemetery when that entire carnival takes place in the title story, asking if the Pope had a fax. Now he's trying to find out if the Pope has an email or a Twitter account to get in touch with the Pope. So I updated it a little bit. Also, the characters are interrelated, so I had to move some characters around so that they would be family members or friends of other characters that appear in the same stories in the book.
Now, one of the things that interests me about this collection as it is now is that it's bookended by Katrina stories.
Yes. The first story is a kind of a gallows humor grotesque that takes place after Katrina. And again, that was sparked by a conversation with a friend of mine, wacky anecdotes about someone in the French Quarter that I've met for 5 minutes.
But what I'm curious to know from your point of view is, where do you think we are with Katrina stories? We're 9 years in now. Do you think we're just beginning to scratch the surface still?
I do, although there were some stories I purposefully didn't include because there were Katrina stories. And I didn't want it to season so heavily the entire book because I did a novel, Higher Ground, which is a comic noir that takes place in the French Quarter after Katrina. So I kind of felt as though I had done Katrina.
Right.
But if you consider the fact that Gone with the Wind was published in the 1930s and it's the Civil War novel, which ended in 1865, or all of the books about World War II that came out in the 1950s, I think we have a long way to go, even though Katrina is, they say in New York, box office poison.
No editor
or agent wants to see anything about Katrina.
Sad. Because I think there's still so much to come as well. So you're going to read today for us from one of my favorite stories in this collection, Hard Freeze. Tell us a little bit about this story.
Well, like a lot of the stories, it kind of happened to me. I was sitting in my French Quarter courtyard one afternoon, listening, of course, to the station, listening to classical music, and my landlady's housekeeper came out of the laundry room. And she put down her laundry basket and she cocked her ear and she said, "That's my nephew on the radio." And I said, "Oh, yeah, he's a great European pianist." And I was a little surprised that this uniformed black lady that I saw every day, Dolores, that her nephew was a famous European pianist. And she told me the story that her brother, after World War II, met a German musician and they had a child together. And had I ever heard of him, his name was André Watts.
Wow.
So the idea began to percolate in my mind of a famous pianist who visits New Orleans to try to find his black Creole family roots here, a family he never got to know. But the character, Emil Jackson, is really completely made up. I did transplant him to France. He's a French pianist now. And again, he knew his father, but he's never connected with the family. And so during his concert, his grandmother and aunt actually turn up in the audience. And they have a reunion backstage. He's staying in what Mrs. McNamara, the head of the Save Our Symphony Committee, calls a vacation slave quarter, which the very term horrifies him. And he's awakened in the morning by a gardener in the courtyard cutting back all the dead vegetation. And he starts talking to him. And he's really, except for Mrs. McNamara, the first New Orleanian he's met. So he's inquiring about his family because he would really like to meet them. And this is part of the conversation and a tiny bit of a flashback. I was born in Nevers, France, where my mother raised me. Woo-wee, Cyril Ducos said, slapping his thigh. France! Didn't he ramble? Didn't he roam, like the songs say? Come to visit your daddy's folks? Not exactly. Are you still in touch with that Jackson family? Emil asked, excited. The Picou Bakery rang a bell. Papa always talked about the jelly donuts at that bakery. Place be long gone. But a few Jacksons still stopped by the old barber shop. I looked in the phone book and there were 4 pages of Jacksons. If you see any of that family you know, please tell them I'm Linton's son and to come hear my concert tonight at the Orpheum Theater. After, they can call for me backstage. I'll run it by Loretha, the old man said with a wink. You know, want to get the word out, only 3 ways, telephone, telegraph, and tell a woman. A chill wind picked up and Emil's coffee turned cold. I have to rehearse now. Mind if I listen while I finish up out here? It would be a great honor, sir. When Emil slipped inside, he left the door cracked open despite the cold, not wanting to break his connection with the gardener. This was as close as he had gotten to his American family since his father's funeral, when he left without speaking a word. Papa had always fumed about those people down there, saying they were narrow-minded and willfully ignorant. As a captain in the United States Army, Linton Jackson had considered himself a man of the world, good as any white man, better. He treated his son like a recruit, demanding order, discipline, and respect. And during the boy's infrequent summer visits to his father's in officer's housing, those few hours that Emil wasn't practicing the piano were spent shining his father's boots to a high gloss. A chart hung on the kitchen door, listing his chores and practice sessions by the hour and day, and he had to check them off as they were completed. When, with great relief, Emil flew back to France, his father shook his hand at the airport as if he had completed an assignment. Emil half expected a grade and was never quite sure if he had passed, either as a son or as a pianist. As a boy practicing on the rented upright in his father's living room, Emil could always hear his father listening, even if the old man's face was hidden behind a newspaper, slurping a gin and tonic. And if the truth be known, every time he played a concert anywhere in the world, he could still feel his father listening. But as he stood to acknowledge with a bow the standing ovations he'd come to expect, he didn't hear the applause, no matter how thunderous, because it was never Papa's.
Excellent. Thank you. I love that story. We've been talking with James Nolan, whose new book of short stories is You Don't Know Me, New and Selected Stories. You can meet him Thursday, October 2nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, or again Thursday, October 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, James.
Thanks for inviting me back, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guests, Amelia Bird and Katie Wallen, start a new season of classes at Baskerville Studio this month. For more information, check out baskervillestudio.com. Michael Rubin reads from and signs The Cotton Crest Curse, Tuesday, September 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Peter Apodee discusses and signs Green in Judgment, Cold in Blood, Tuesday, September 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Three authors of new children's books discuss and sign their works Tuesday, September 23rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. They are Christy Johnston Rice, author of When the Lights Went Out in the City, Laura Dragon, author of Hurricane Boy, and Kristen Hedgebeth, author of This Day. Carolyn Cobb discusses and signs New Orleans Memories, One Writer's City, Wednesday, September 24th at 1 p.m. at the meeting of the Friends of Jefferson Public Library. That's at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Mark Stewart Jones signs his novel Roland, Mr. Bones, Thursday, September 25th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Gina Ferrara reads from and signs her book of poems, Carville, Sunday, September 28th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. On Monday, September 29th, Octavia Books will be moderating a tweet chat discussion for One Book, One New Orleans selection this year, Unfathomable City, A New Orleans Atlas. That's Monday, September 29th from 6 to 7. You will need to have a Twitter account, and you can either follow the hashtag Obono14, that's O-B-O-N-O-14, or go to tweet chat to follow along there. So far, Rebecca Snedeker and Maurice Ruffin have confirmed they will participate. Poet Tracy K. Smith, who received the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for her book, Life on Mars, reads Monday, September 29th at 7:30 in the Freeman Auditorium, Oldenburg Arts Center at Tulane University. Today's guest, James Nolan, reads from and signs You Don't Know Me, October 2nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. October is a really busy month, and we wanted to let you know about a couple of things coming up. October 3rd through 5th is ContraFlow, the annual science fiction and fantasy convention, most of which takes place at the Airport Hilton in Kenner. There will be 35 guests on hand, including award-winning science fiction writer Gregory Benford, as well as a full program of events, panels, parties. For more information, go to ContraFlowSciFi.org. The Friends of the Jefferson Parish Library hold their big book sale October 16th through 19th at the Pontchartrain Center. The New Orleans Museum of Art and the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans celebrate National Reading Group Month in October, with readings around the Big Easy Saturday, October 18th, an all-day event featuring local writers and celebrating local book clubs and reading groups. It's free with NOMA admission, except for Tea with the Authors, which requires registration. Check out NOMA.org for more information. The Tulane English Department and Newcomb College Institute sponsor Thinking on the Page, Women in Biography and Memoir. That's a day-long symposium featuring Patricia Bosworth, Vivian Gornick, Wendy Lesser, and Brenda Wineapple, Saturday, October 25th at Freeman Auditorium, Woldenburg Arts Center at Tulane. The Louisiana Book Festival will hold a series of word shops, October 31st, the day before the festival itself. Offerings include Finding the Story, led by Jill McCorkle, Breaking the Rules, a teen writing workshop for the creatively hyperactive, led by Mark Dunn. You can do a graphic novel, led by Barbara Slate. Making Poems Out of Your Own Experience, led by State Poet Laureate Ava Lavelle Heyman. The Lovely Bones, Organizing Your Research and Your Writing, led by Earl Swift. For more information and to register, check out LouisianaBookFestival.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.